It's a great Monday here. We got a lot of great stuff coming up to you, coming up for you. As usual, it's a little AI heavy this week. I hope you know it's going to be an AI week. We've got a lot for you to watch. You're watching Techstorm Gang. Hey everyone. Here's to Monday, start of a new week, and we're starting the week off on a heavy AI news front, it looks like. Let me introduce you to our gang members today here on TechStorm Gang. First of all, one of our roving gang members from the wild hills of New Mexico. She's also the CEO of Deploy Hub and co-host of TechStorm Women, our good friend Tracy Reagan. Tracy, welcome. How are you?
I'm doing great. Glad to be here, Alan.
Good to have you on. Joining Tracy and myself today, again, from the Mile High City, no reflection on his current state of mind, is our CTO and principal research analyst at TechStrong Research, Mitch Ashley. Hey, Mitchell, welcome.
Welcome, Alan. Good to be here. Good to be with the gang.
Mm-hmm. And joining Mitchell, Tracy, and I, to my left, hailing from the Bronx, our chief content officer, Mike Rizzard.
All right, let's go Yankees.
Yeah, huh? Go Yankees is right. All righty. So team, as I said earlier, it's going to be a big AI day, it looks like, today in terms of our news. And that's nothing news. I mean, nothing new. I mean, AI is just...
It's everywhere.
Everywhere and then everything. The first kind of bit is a piece coming off of Security Boulevard. And it's really about, you know, is AI going to help us with AppSec?
Yeah, it's interesting. Evans Data has a survey out there that says roughly a third of the developers they talk to expect AI will improve the security of the code they write. And of course, you know, I looked at that and I scratched my chin a little bit and I went, so two-thirds. Does that mean two-thirds don't expect it to help them at all? And they think that they are... fine as they are, because the evidence would suggest maybe not. And the other thing is, well, and I'm going to kick this to Tracy, you know, are just a third of all developers not good coders in the first place, and it's just the nature of the business. So, Tracy, what are your thoughts here?
I think there's a lot of opportunity in code development when it comes to AI. However, I don't believe it's going to solve problems at the initial coding state. So in other words, I don't know if AI is going to generate any better code than a developer would write. You know, we do static code analysis. In fact, I was at the Secure Open Source Software Conference about a couple weeks ago, and I was kind of disappointed to hear some of the individuals who are running some of these working groups talk about how static code analysis is really all we have to do. But the problem is in the statement. It's static, right? So if we think about, if we go beyond just doing development and generating code and we start looking at how AI can apply the remediation of vulnerabilities, now that gets me excited. I mean, we're doing a lot of that research right now at Deploy Hub. The idea that if you track the code with the deployment and the SBOM, would AI then would allow you to say, okay, I know there's a vulnerability in this package. It's listed as high. I'm going to go out and find the correct new package, bring it in, and redeploy. Boy, wouldn't that help us? According to JFrog, it's taking us 227 days to remediate a vulnerability. AI can fix that. But I don't really see that as part of the development process. I see that as the DevSecOps process where AppSec kind of fits in. So yes and no. AI may generate better code, but if it pulls from its examples that already has bad code, it's just going to create, you know, the same thing that a human would. And that's kind of what AI is supposed to do anyway. What we have to do is start developing more AI, collecting, gathering more data, understanding the threats, understanding threat models, and start building out these LLMs that can actually solve problems post-coding. And that's where I think AI is going to do the most.
Mitchell, is this an unreasonable expectation for developers to write more secure code? We've talked about this in the past where we want to shift left, but to Tracy's point, we give them all these tools and then they get inundated with alerts. And a lot of them were absent that day when they were supposed to be taking that cybersecurity elective. And they don't know what those alerts mean. And they just ignore them and hope that, you know, something good happens on the back end. But how did we get where we are?
Well, boy, developers love more alerts.
Not.
Well, this improve it? I think it will improve it. And to Tracy's point, I think one way it will is we take the broad suite of data of code that goes into LLMs for doing software development. We can refine that LLM to do better jobs at writing secure code. It's much like we would say, well, we'll train our developers to write better code. Well, in theory, with an LLM, that should be a more reliable way to do that. I think security is so broad, it's difficult to train developers on all the ways of thinking about how you write more secure code, and that's where SAST and DAST and other things come into play. My problem with it, though, is that's just one place in the software supply chain where security, where we have to address security for DevSecOps. And developers writing unsecure code is part of it, but you've got a lot of code coming in the developers didn't write. You have a lot of things that you're integrating with. You have the stack of software it's running on, that all of that could have security vulnerabilities. It could be the cloud infrastructure that's just being deployed onto. So it's one drop in the bucket, I think, of the security things that we need to do, and anything we do to improve that part of it is a good thing.
And I want to say that I feel like the developers are getting a lot put on their plate.
Mm-hmm.
And in most organizations, it's true. Most of the developers, they're becoming the entry-level positions, especially with, generating code. It's going to even be more so. And more senior developers are going to be off doing other things. So I really do believe that it's going to be hard to train our way out of this problem. I don't believe we can either train or scan our way out of this problem at that first step, at when a piece of code gets committed to a repo. So I really do feel that the solution is going to be in better automated tools and managing the pipeline and catching things and using AI to really predict vulnerabilities and not put it on the developer's shoulders to say, hey, that string copy function you use is using some library that has a transitive dependency that now has a vulnerability. There's no way that they're going to know that. It's almost unfair for them to be asked to try to know all of that all the time.
I totally agree.
You know, I think going back to the survey reference then here, and you look at that, and you ask, well, two-thirds didn't think it's not that two-thirds didn't think it's going to improve security. I think there's some people who just, I think when you ask developers about AI improving the security of code, it's not just about they don't think of it as just about the code they're writing being insecure. They're looking at the totality of application security, not just as it relates to them, right? And I think Mitchell touched on it and Tracy touched on it a little. There's more to application security than the developer coding the code. There is SAST and DAST and software composition analysis, SCA scan, and you know all of these things. AppSec, there's many facets of AppSec that AI can interact with and make it better for developers and make it, more importantly, better to have, you know, more secure code, more secure applications. And so I do think that AI will overall improve application security without hopefully putting more burden on the developers. I think that developers, no one sets out developing insecure code. Mm-hmm. However, I just also think that we need to be realistic about how AI can be used to thwart application security, right? And it's almost for every good that it could do, there's a corresponding potential pitfall there too. So
it's a game of whack-a-mole. It really is, especially right now. Mm-hmm. You know, and just like in QA, you can't, oftentimes you can catch a lot, but you can't always QA your way out of bugs in production. You can catch some, but there's things are going to get through.
Well, is this a moment in time, though? And Tracy, I think you touched on it lightly, but so today the LLM is trained on pretty much code pulled from across the web, written by people who were imperfect, so the code is imperfect. And it probably has
vulnerabilities exactly.
in it as well. But is the next generation of these things going to be an LLM that's been trained using code that's been vetted so we'll get better outputs on the other side of this and maybe developers will trust it more?
Well, and that was what I was saying, Mike, is that when you're getting code out of an LLM, there's just from across the internet, you get what you get. Mm-hmm. As we train those models to be more, you know, to generate better quality code or more secure code or whatever things we do to, you know, up the game, the good thing about that is not only does it do a better job of it, it does it consistently. You know, you don't have to train the next developer on secure code or this esoteric thing to watch out for. That's built into the model. So I think that is where the promise of AI is building better models at writing secure code. And that being something that will consistently do that for us, not just one point in time.
And none of that's going to ever stop another XZ backdoor from happening.
No.
That's just the reality of it. And if you looked at the process that individual went through to get that in that code, he planned it for a while. It was, you know, he worked at it. He worked at it to build trust and get his pull request accepted. So, again, it's a game of whack-a-mole. And I do believe that AI will help. I think where AI is going to be the best is in remediating. We don't need to remediate manually. And that's where I think AI is going to provide the biggest. It's the chaos engineering theory, right? It's not about trying to stop. Well, that is a good, that, you know, that is a good guardrail to prevent these things from coming into our supply chain. But once they're in that supply chain and we don't know about it, how do we respond as quickly as possible? And that will be our best defense. Fast remediation. And, you know, I always say we need a FEMA response. We need to be able to organize a FEMA response. We need to know and be able to communicate to organizations when there is a vulnerability that everybody should know about it. And how do we get that information out? And how do they remediate as quickly as possible? So, and then we can ask later how it got there.
Huh? You're singing my tune.
Yeah.
Response is important.
Yeah.
Doing it quickly.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I always tend to look at things when I flip them over, and I scratch my head around that sabotage of that module, because there was probably 100 other ways to compromise that entire environment that was a lot easier. And yet, for some reason, you know, he spent the better part of months, maybe even a year or more, infiltrating into that project and then injecting this malware.
3 years.
Yeah, does this mean that maybe we're getting better at application security? Because certainly the bar to achieve what he has needed to achieve is a lot was higher than it used to be. I mean, kind of used to be, I would just kind of steal your credentials and inject some code and go home for and, you know, be done by lunch.
Well, first, a lot of that trust building was through SOC Clippet email accounts and automation. It wasn't like, you know, it was person to person building all that trust relationship. The other is, that's one data point. There are others that this has happened to. So that same person could have been doing this across 25 projects, not just one. And that's the one that, because he targeted it, because it was something that was in the Linux kernel, it's going to get wide distribution. If it pays off, it's a good payday, right? So I think it's a model of attacking open source software projects. An instance of that, I think there's a lot more, and that's what Ryan.
Yeah, I think that's the one we found, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
that's
This is like joint interdiction.
Yeah, I know. Well, you know, infiltration like that is, you know, standard espionage fare, right, from a John Le Clair novel or something.
And, sleeper cell, right?
Yeah, and sleeper cells. I think this is. When you think about it, yes, it takes time. It's a low and slow kind of attack, maybe, right, versus what you're talking about. But it's also not a very sophisticated, right? You don't need to, you know, crack passwords or brute force things. you just, you know, you show up and you participate, or you pretend to, or whatever. And it's a low and slow way in until you get to a position of trust, and then boom. And like I said, I think this is the one we found. This 3.9, we've talked about this in the last gang. There's 3.9 million open source projects out there. How many of them have been infiltrated this way? I think it's the new red menace. I have here in my hand a paper.
Well, let me ask Tracy, are we moving from the, I used to call it the smash and grab era of cybersecurity breaches, and these are going to be more, to his point, you know, slow burns?
Well, that...
I don't think we've left this. I think that we're straddling both worlds right now. You know, we talk about finding all these vulnerabilities. We're just starting to look for them. So now we're reporting all these vulnerabilities, right? So we're just now starting to touch it. We've barely put our toe in the water, in my opinion, in terms of really addressing it. This has always been there.
Exactly. I was just going to say advanced threat prevention, right? We hit this in security. Same thing happened.
It's been around for a while now. This is the low and slow method, right? Yeah. This is what they do.
It's not the 50,000 bot hits that you got in 10 minutes. It's low and slow across weeks, days, weeks, months before the actual break-in occurs. You don't notice it because the time is so spread out. You don't see the events are connected.
This is, to me, that's exactly what it is. Anyway, we need
that XY backdoor vulnerability, though. It was a lot easier than trying to get past pen testing.
Yeah,
no, that's what that's I'm
a much
this,
easier.
This
yeah,
it's a low and slow technique that will bypass a lot of the smash and grab defenses that we have.
All right, I got fingers and toes crossed that application security is going to be better a year from now.
It will be, but so will the bad guys.
So will they. Yeah. So
and that's the nature of this beast. I've lived here for 20-something years, and I don't know what changes fundamentally. Anyway, we're going to take a break here on the gang. We're going to be back with more AI stuff. Is NVIDIA trying to solve the GPU shortage? Do they have an incentive to? Let's find out.
All right, and we're back. So last week, NVIDIA confirmed that they were acquiring an outfit called Run AI. I don't know how else to do Run semicolon AI or whatever it is, but at its core, this is a platform that runs on top of Kubernetes and its workflow orchestration, and it's designed to help you maximize the utilization of the underlying GPUs. Most of those GPUs are currently being used to train the AI models, and they're scarce and hard to find, and they're expensive. So it's kind of surprising to see NVIDIA buy something that makes it more efficient in the first place to use those GPUs, because it's not clear to me that that's necessarily in their best interest, but I guess keeping customers happy is a good thing. But it also seems to me, and I'll start with you, because I know we were talking to some of our friends at Fujorum about this, but... Are GPUs just going to wind up being used to train the AI model, and we're going to use other processors that are less expensive, easier to get to run the inference engines wherever we need to run them, and there's going to be a split here?
Well, maybe there'll be something better than GPUs to train on as well. I mean, here, you know, my first, I got to tell you how cynical I've become. My first reaction to this, given the... goings on at the criminal trial in New York City was this a National Enquirer? What do they call it? Hunt and kill, or
catch and kill.
Are they buying this company to kind of kibosh it so that people need more GPUs? Now, let's not be that cynical. they're really going to sell these things.
They promised to leave it as a standalone end.
Right. Yeah, the road to perdition is paved with promises. But you know, at the end of the day, in my mind, is this really going to mitigate the GPU shortage? Hell no. Stop. Come on. This is, I mean, what are they looking for here? Metal or just a pin in on? This is not mitigating the GPU shortage. Yeah, I just, you know, yesterday I also saw a picture of a Jensen, is it Wong, right? Is this CEO with Sam Altman delivering to OpenAI the latest, greatest, you know, NVIDIA super package with an inscription, you know, for the good of mankind or something like that. And I was, you know, the recipe for man, I was thinking of that old Twilight Zone.
Again, 10 people know what you're talking about.
I know.
It's people. It's like Sven and Green.
But they're my 10 people. You know, but that's the way I see this. I mean, the only thing that's going to mitigate the GPU shortage is something that really turns on GPU production, which you don't turn up foundries in 6 months, right? In fabs. So, you know, that's a while out. Or we come up with a better mousetrap than GPUs to do this job. I don't think, you know, putting AI workloads on Kubernetes more efficiently than it is now moves the needle at all. So, you know, I'm being a survey today.
So you're not going to short NVIDIA, is that what you're saying?
I'm not shorting it. Well, now's a buying time. The stock has taken a huge hit. Mm-hmm. Or I haven't seen it in the last couple of days, but it took a big hit. But here's the other thing. This is AI clickbait, as far as I'm concerned. This is the kind of stuff that's sucking the oxygen out of our tech world, tech news world. Where I, you know, let's talk about something other than AI. Let's talk about making Kubernetes more efficient, period, right? Let's talk about, you know, how we can do more with Kubernetes and get more people using it. But instead, if you put a little AI news on it, we're all running to it.
We were just at KubeCon, and all anybody talked about was how to make Kubernetes more efficient to run what? AI?
It's the world we're living in today, and, you know, but this too shall pass.
I'm going to take an even deeper cynical view, Alan, which is you could look at this as a way to sell more chips, not to address the shortage problem. So if you're, you know, we know Kubernetes well, right? This is, you know, Kubernetes for AI training models, et cetera. So if you're more efficient, better, you're better at distributing those workloads across whatever centers instead of I can put my own stuff here. Well, guess what? You're going to use a lot more CPUs and a lot more locations, edge, you know, at the core, all that stuff. So you could look at this as a way of, no, I want NVIDIA chips everywhere, so my workflow orchestrator will run on all that stuff.
Yeah, if I could find them, I would agree, but I think that's the issue, is they're just generating shortage.
it was kind of a head scratcher for me when I saw that article come through. Because I don't know if run AI, like Alan says, it has AI in it, so let's suck all the oxygen out of the air. But I don't, you know, I've never looked at that solution, but I really don't know how much AI is in it. Kubernetes can be a little hard to manage. It's complex. They tried to make it simple. Microsoft wrote a book called Fippy Goes to the Zoo to try to break out how Kubernetes actually works. But to be able to spin up, more space and get more GPUs out of the process. I don't know if everybody's achieved that. And tools like Run AI could be useful. However, I think open source communities and people are already writing them themselves. So 700 million was a lot for that tool. That's what I was thinking at the time. Because I don't know if I don't really see the market for it, but I could totally be wrong. Because maybe people would prefer to buy a tool that would help them spin up, more clusters or more namespaces and build out more GPUs. But as you have all already said, it's just going to mean that it's going to have more chips and bigger processing. So I always like to talk about quantum computing. If we really want to fix the problem, it's not going to be from run AI. And it's going to be, you know, IBM's work in the quantum space. And eventually, I believe that's where we're going to go to. So, and I, you know, I'm surprised that the Linux Foundation hasn't started a project that's similar to run AI, for example. So that, you know, that kind of processing, I believe, will be, you know, solved in other ways. Yeah, so I was surprised.
It may be that the TOC for Kubernetes finally gets around to solving this run the AI workloads better issue themselves as a project. But let me ask you, Tracy, is it getting harder to write software? Because it's like, you know, there's so many processors in the zoo today. There's GPUs and x86 and ARMs and DPUs. And it's not like the old days where I just had a compiler and an x86 and away I went. It seems like it's getting more challenging.
I think the problem is not it's harder to write software. In a microservices environment, things become more complex. And there is an association to usage of a particular service that there's an operational side of that software. So we have developers writing, you know, APIs and functions, and we have operation teams trying to observe how they're being consumed and what we have to do to spin them up. And if we think about in the AI world, if you think about AI agents, they're going to be highly fragmented, running in all kinds of locations. Which is going to require more tooling like Run AI to help spin up more resources and better manage resources so that we can better consume GPUs without buying more computing power. So I think that's where the problem is. And it's a problem between dev and ops and better management of Kubernetes itself. And understanding how these functions are working and who's consuming them and where they're at and what versions are running across different environments and who's connecting to them. It's very complex. It really is. But the development side has gotten a lot easier with Kubernetes. You can write in your own language. You don't have to, you know, if you want to write in Go, write in Go. If you want to write in Python, write in Python. You can write one little function and everybody else can consume it. So there's a lot to be said about this new decoupled architecture from the ease of coding, but boy, does it get complicated on the operation side.
Well, Mitchell, do you think that the management of the inference engines is going to shift over to DevOps? Because today, right, it sits within these kind of MLOps data science teams, and I feel like the thing is going to split where the training will be left to the data science folks, but the implementation is going to be just part of your standard DevOps workflow.
I've talked about this before. I think it behooves us to make it part of the workflow, one of the workflow work streams that are going on in a DevOps process. And it'll have its own kind of gravity of how frequently and what comes with it, because it's got data and training that go with models and all that. But it can't be this thing over on the side, because it may help do the AI work, but the interdependencies between applications and systems that are using those functions, you have to be able to coordinate interdependent releases or components of code. So the best thing, and I actually wrote a paper for one of the container vendors around containerizing and starting your AI work in the AI expert teams, you know, in the data scientist teams, so that they can eventually become part of that workflow. So I don't think it just kind of disappears in the workflow. I think it's got its own unique characteristics, but it's part of the workflow across the DevOps pipeline.
DevOps, I like ending on DevOps. We're going to take a break on Tech Strong on Tech Strong Gang today. We'll be back with some. Is it a Rolling Stones song? No, it's not. But we'll be back.
I'm Bonnie Schneider, sustainability contributor to the Tech Strong Group. I'm excited to introduce you to a groundbreaking new initiative from Tech Strong Research, the Sustainability Pulse Meter. The Pulse Meter offers valuable insights into how environmental responsibility factors into tech purchasing decisions for key players in the industry. Position your company as a leader in the industry and differentiate from your competitors with the Sustainability Pulse Meter, offered exclusively from Tech Strong Research.
And we're back with our third and final segment. The folks at Salesforce were in New York last week, and they were touting all their new AI capabilities. But buried in there was a survey they put out that noted that more than half the folks that they talked to, who were knowledge workers, said they couldn't get AI to do what they wanted. They were frustrated, and it was just, they couldn't get the outputs. It was, the prompts are too hard to master. And so I know you're a big AI advocate, but, you know, are we just doing that and we're just throwing prompts at people and saying, go figure it out? Or do we need to kind of think this through a little bit better?
Before I answer that, though, I just want to call out the name of this here. You can't get what your AI want, right? You can't always get what AI wants, right? To paraphrase.
But you get what you need.
But you do get what you need. And, you know, shout out to Jagger and Mick Jagger. Who's my favorite?
Keith Richards.
Jeez.
And Prevagen is now a sponsor for the show.
Yes. Well, I had a little mental block about Keith Richards. Okay. Wouldn't be the first time. But anyway, so you know, I talk to people about AI all the time, and some people are knowledge workers, as I think you called them. Mm-hmm. And some people are just, you know, not knowledge workers. And that kind of, I guess that's a good way of looking at the world, those who are and those who aren't. But the biggest thing I think today is for most people, AI still means that ChatGPT prompt, mm-hmm. right? They're not using the co-pilot aspect that's integrated into, let's say, Slack now and everything. I mean, we've all seen these in our applications. There's always this little blue button, get AI or use AI or what would AI do or whatever, and you click that. I don't know how many people, I mean, I do because I like to see what it comes up with, but for most people, it's still, they're sitting at a chatbot prompt, and what they get is a direct result of what prompt they put in. And 90% of people don't know how to prompt well. That's really the issue. I agree with the survey there. The AI you get is the AI you put in the prompt. And we need to train people. Because, I mean, in my own personal journey, it's made a huge difference. You know, we did that hackathon that we have on TechStrong TV with the operationalizing AI, talking to those guys, learning about how to do prompt. You want to call it prompt engineering. I don't know if it rises to that level. But learning how to do a proper prompt makes all the difference in the world. I think young people who will be... you know, Gen AI natives are going to know it intuitively how to do great prompts. I think old people like us, we need to learn how to do prompts if we're going to really get out of AI what we want.
Tracy, do we need to go to prompt camp this summer?
Oh, yes. I agree with everything that Al was saying. I know from my own experience, I'll use ChatGPT and I was like, wow, that was definitely not the right question. What is the right question to ask so I can get the correct information back? But, you know, I want to step back for a minute. We do need to go to prompt camp. I mean, that's for sure. But the thing about Salesforce has a massive amount of data. And these companies who have been gathering data for years and years and years, just like GitHub, they have a big advantage over everybody else in terms of being able to execute and apply AI in different kinds of situations. Certainly, when we get to a point where Salesforce can say, hey, based on the people who are your contacts, we know and deliver this to me in an easy way, or if I could just simply do a prompt in Salesforce and ask who's searching for these kinds of things and do the prompt correctly, and it gives me back a nice list of the correct leads, That's going to save me so much time. But it's because they have the data, and it's the data that I always get excited about. Who's got big data and what can they do with it? And Salesforce has big data. So their Slack AI, if they're, you know, and of course Slack and Discord, that has a ton of data. anytime that somebody's responding and complaining, let's say, about a product, or there's common problems that are coming across through the Slack channel, you're getting a ton of information about your community. And I find that an extremely useful set of data points that I've not been able to see before. So I applaud Salesforce and where they're going with what they're doing, but we all need to get better at understanding how to ask the right questions, no doubt.
Mitchell, you run our IT environment, and one of the things about Slack AI is that it will connect not just to the Salesforce data, but it connects to Google and it connects to LinkedIn. But what it doesn't connect to, surprisingly, is other CRMs, at least not without some additional programming help. Do you think as AI evolves that we're going to change out our platforms because of the capabilities of a given prompt engine, or are we just going to wait for all this stuff to become, you know, everybody's going to have a prompt AI capability, so we don't need to switch out platforms?
Well, you're pointing out a really good problem, which is I'm overrun with copilots and chatbots that are AI, right? Every damn tool that we use, I get an email saying, we now have AI for an extra $10 a user, which is what Slack's price is. We'll add AI to it. The problem is you don't know what you'll get for it until you go out and experiment and use it, and some are going to be better than others. So I feel like we're in the land of, you know, I have one hammer and everybody's selling nails, and I don't need everybody to sell me nails. I just need some better solutions. So I think the vendors that are really good at fine-tuning the use cases and the value that you get from using it, not just connecting it so you can query all this other crap, you know, I don't need that. I've got enough things to query. And yes, I need to go to prompt camp too. So I think we're in this era where it's the low-hanging fruit of AI is just add it to your product and connect it to whatever you can connect it to. And I'm not minimizing of it. It's a good start, but that's not the answer.
No, and that's the promise. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Tracy.
The part of the problem is when it comes to even investors, they only want to look at AI products. They're, you know, that's the shiny new object, and you could have a great product and a great pitch. If you don't have something about AI in it, they don't even want to hear it. So everybody's running to be, you know, relevant. And so they're adding, you know, they're trying to add AI to their products. I just upgraded something on WordPress, and one of the plugins wanted me to upgrade for $10 a month to their AI version. I was like, what does it do? Why do I need it? Do I really need to spend $120 a month for your AI version? I don't know why.
Are you going to be able to charge extra for AI? And I'm asking the question because a lot of times I bought the software in the first place. I'm only getting 20% of the functionality out of it because it's too hard to use. So is it not incumbent upon the vendor to give me a tool to get the rest of the value that I already paid for?
Having AI integrated into your product is table stakes. It already is table stakes. Mm-hmm. If you don't have an AI story about your product, go home. The fact that we're sitting here for 45 minutes and all we're talking about is AI, and we do this 3 days a week and we're supposed to talk about everything, is proof in the pudding. If you don't have an AI story, go home. And if you don't have AI integrated into whether it's your word processor or whatever application, you're not going to be able to charge for that. It's expected.
Yeah, it's like, would you pay for the spell checker now? No, I wouldn't.
Yeah.
But you used to be able to buy spell checkers long, long time ago, right? It's going to be it's a feature. It's not a product. Not in that level anyway.
No.
But there are these massive data centers out there that are processing all these prompts and running all these context windows. So how do we pay for that, Tracy?
Yeah, I don't know. But it is the data that matters. Yeah, ask AI. Ask ChatGPT.
Let's fashion a prompt for that. AI, how do we pay for you?
Yeah, because data can be expensive.
By the way, we've all been to prompt camp already. It's called Google. We know how to craft prompts to get what out of Google. This is the new kind of prompt.
I was sitting here thinking while we were talking, what a great little thing we should do in the winter, bring people down here to South Florida for prompt camp, mm-hmm. right? Combine it with some fun in the sun some light, how to do prompts right, and we have like a group kind of thing. This could be the next great business.
Yeah. I went to prompt camp in Boca, and all I got was this TechStrong t-shirt.
Maybe we combine it with like Ozempic or Wegovy or something and lose weight while learning to prompt. I don't know.
I think, though, you know, the machines are teaching us how to think, right? Because we're structuring things to get more interesting information out of the machines, and where the sign of intelligence, they say, is not so much how you know as much as it is how to frame the question. And I think that Gen AI is teaching us all, or will teach us all, how to frame the questions better, and as did search for that matter. So maybe we're all about to learn something we didn't know.
It's interesting. I think a lot of people, unfortunately, especially not knowledge workers, they still think of it as some like parlor trick. And they're not taking the time to do prompts better because they don't know that's what they need to do. As I said, as kids come up, you'll see that become a real thing. Anyway, though, we're out of time. We've been going on here. Tracy, I want to thank you for joining us. As always, it's a pleasure to have you on. Mitchell,
we'll talk
in a little bit. Mike, thank you. Most of all, hey, thank you guys out there for joining us with TechStrong Gang. We've been doing this now over a month, and it's a blast. We love doing it. But you know what? We don't hear a lot in terms of what you guys would like to hear and see on the gang. So if you do, write to TechStrong Gang at TechStrongGroup.com with any suggestions, comments, and we'd love to hear them. Also, we will be expanding the gang. We're on a gang recruitment kick. And we're going to join in with some of our future analysts joining the gang and other personalities. So stay tuned. We'll keep it fresh. We'll try to do as much AI as you can take, but more. And that's it. Have a great week here. You've just watched the TechStrong Gang.
SecurityBoulevard.com is the leading resource for news, analysis, and education on challenges facing the cybersecurity industry. SecurityBoulevard.com covers all aspects of cybersecurity, including data security, DevSecOps, cloud security, application security, network security, security threats, and more. SecurityBoulevard.com has the largest selection of security content, featuring breaking news, blog posts, podcasts, and more. Visit www.securityboulevard.com to learn more. SecurityBoulevard.com, home of Security Bloggers Network.